I don't have my notes here. Oh, here they are.
Good.
Thanks for choosing that hymn, Beth. That's a great one. That it totally fits, actually, with our theme this evening. And I did the obvious this time, and walking on water, and here we are, we're reading Matthew 11. Often I like to take it from some obscure passage and somehow draw it together. But this time I'd picked the obvious reading. And we're going to be basing our thoughts out of Matthew 14, actually the three Gospels that have this record in it. But this, in the hymn, it struck me, verse 2 of the hymn, where it says, "Turn from home and toil and kindred, leaving all for his dear sake." And this idea of home and where we make our home is something that we're going to be thinking about a lot tonight. Now, when we think of walking on the water, we often relate that to the impossible. In fact, in day-to-day speech, you often, well, actually, I haven't heard it recently, but I've heard people say, oh, that's like walking on water. It's an impossibility. And so we might ask ourselves, okay, well, if we were to walk on water, we're given a project and we have to walk on water, how would we do it? Well, we're going to need a prop. And for me, I thought of inflatable shoes. And because it kind of relates to something that it's from my childhood, which isn't that far away. Inflatable shoes. Now, I'm going to tell you how I remember this event. Some members of my family might disagree. I don't remember if they were even with me at the time. I think you must have been there. Only my mom is out there tonight. But here's how it happened, according to me. I was at Okanagan Lake, and we used to go there every summer, well, many summers, because my grandpa had a cabin there. And we'd go there, and we'd go water skiing and spend the day at the lake, and it's really nice. It got hot, and so people are in the water. Well, one day I was sitting on a chair or maybe on the beach or something. I was looking down a few cabins out on one of the docks, and someone is there and they're kind of sitting on the edge of the dock, and he's got these, actually I don't even remember if it's male or female or how old the person was, but they had these shoe things that they're putting on, strapping to their feet. Maybe I dreamt this, I don't know. But it's clear in my mind. And so he puts these shoes on, and then he gets kind of edges over to the end of the dock, and he puts one foot down in the water, and then puts the other foot down in the water, and I thought, oh, this is really cool. I want a pair of those, and I can walk on the water too. And so I expect the guy, you know, he'd just stand up and start walking out into the middle of the lake. Well, he didn't do that. As soon as he stretched out, he just went and fell backwards, and well, he did it a few times and then kind of gave up. That's what I remember. His buoyancy was all wrong, because once you fall, you've got these things strapped to your feet, and all of a sudden your feet are light-weighted, and so your head's down here, and you need your head to breathe. So it just kind of seems opposite. So, well, not just breathing, you need it to think and all those other things too. But to survive, you need to breathe as well. So you need your head on top of the water, and these inflatable shoes are keeping your feet on top of the water, which kind of seemed opposite. But even so, I thought to myself, oh, if I had a pair of those, I bet I could do it. And I thought, it occurred to me, do we do this spiritually? And do we attempt the impossible through our own confidence and our own pride, and then come crashing down, and then try again and come crashing down? It reminds me of a song. Many things remind me of songs, and a line from a song: "The impossible will take a little while." And What does that mean? Does it mean that anything is possible for us if we just kind of give it time? Does it mean that we can achieve anything ourselves if we give it time? Let's qualify what we mean by impossible. In some year back a while ago, I wasn't alive. Neil Armstrong stepped on the moon. People probably remember what year that was. I don't, because I wasn't alive. 200 years ago, they would have thought, well, yeah, right. Anyone's going to the moon, that's pretty unlikely. That's impossible. And yet, a man landed on the moon. He stepped on the moon and came back, and he's still alive. I don't know if he's alive right now, but he was alive when he landed back on the earth. So we sent men to the moon. The impossible, what was thought impossible, was possible. So is the impossible achievable for us? I mean, this was hard work and dedication and research and time and money and training and technology, and it all made this huge undertaking and dangerous undertaking possible. So what's impossible then? This was a technological achievement, really. But it didn't change people. It didn't change them fundamentally. We still had hate, and we still had war, and we still had terrorism, and we still had greed. And human nature was not changed. That's the impossible. The impossible is only made possible by God. God says that he will change us in the twinkling of an eye at the last trumpet. Where are we in Matthew 14? Thinking about the impossible. Well, the context of Matthew 14, or of these events, of Jesus walking on the water, and of Peter walking on the water, and of the disciples in the storm, it wasn't too long before this that John the Baptist was beheaded. And after that, the disciples and Jesus, they went across the lake and to the other side where this crowd found them, and where subsequently Jesus fed the 5,000. This is the feeding of the 5,000. After the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus goes up to a mountain, the disciples go into a boat, and they go back across the lake and go home. But they get stuck halfway. Jesus walks to them on the water. We know the story. I think it's a really important point to consider that the disciples and Jesus crossed over at the beginning, and this is in Mark 6. If we look at Mark 6, and we're actually going to be flipping between the three passages. So we have Matthew 14, Mark 6, and John 6 that we're going to be flipping between a bit. In Mark 6 and verse 32, we read, "And they went away in the boat to a desolate place by themselves." And also in John 1:1, it says, "Sometime after this, Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee." So here they are, they find themselves, and they've crossed over the water. And I'm going to borrow some points that John Popel made in his book, John's Creation. So some of it might be a little bit familiar, but I think that I couldn't agree with him more. Here we have the disciples and Jesus crossing over the water, and this is baptism. Because what do they do after that? They have communion with Christ. They share bread with Christ. They've left their human homes, and they've crossed the sea to be with Christ. But their mindset was still wrong. We have Jesus going up onto the mountain in John 6, verse 15. And the direction is interesting. Jesus goes up to the mountain. Well, the mountain is up, so he's going up. The disciples are going down to the lake. And John emphasizes this, that Christ is going up, the disciples are going down. And this is important. Why do we have this separation between Jesus and his disciples? And it's interesting because the other Gospels give it the slant that Jesus sent them away. In fact, if we go to Matthew 14 again, and in verse 22, it says, immediately Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. So it seems that Jesus is splitting them up on purpose. Why is he doing this? And I think it's because the disciples haven't grown. They haven't accepted that this is their new life with Christ yet. And they go down to the sea. Why do I say this? Well, in John, it talks in verse 15, it says, Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him a king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. So the people wanted to make him king. We know the disciples, time and time again, wanted to make him king then and there. This was a temptation that Christ struggled with, that he had to overcome. It was something that was a real temptation for him. And so he forces the separation because at this point, and think about this personally too. Sometimes we are so able to resist some temptation, and that sometime later, that same temptation is a real problem for us. And we have to know when we've got to lay it aside and move away from it. And that's what happens here. The disciples go down to the sea. They go down, and there's a progression here. They go down, it gets dark, there are waves and wind, they're in the middle of the lake, and it's stormy. And it progresses and gets progressively worse. In John 6, verses 16 to 18, we have this progression. By now it was dark, and Jesus had not yet joined them. So without Christ, it was dark. And a strong wind was blowing, the waters grew rough. Their intent was to go back home. But their home wasn't with Christ where it should have been, it was back in Galilee. Their physical home. They hadn't found a home in Jesus because they still felt and held on to their comfort. And then all of a sudden they're in the thick of it. John 6, verse 19, says that they were three and a half miles into the lake. Mark says they were halfway across. Apparently that's about right. For people that have maps with miles and kilometers and stuff, you can measure it. And apparently they're halfway across the lake. They're right in the middle. Just like us when we choose to go our own way. And we find ourselves stuck in the middle of a situation that we realize we're not equipped for. We can't try to go back to who we were before we were baptized. And yet, we choose to try. We try to return home to our old home. Yet we have to work on making our new home with Christ our real home. Making this where true comfort is. Okay. Here's a question for you. I don't know if it occurred to you, but I asked myself, well, why did Jesus have to walk on the water? Of all things, why did he choose such a spectacular thing to do? In the middle of a storm, there he is walking on the water. That's pretty impressive. Why did he have to do this? Why was it necessary? What purpose did it serve? what is he trying to show the disciples, and what is he trying to show us? The disciples had gone their own way. They had forgotten God was in control. They had forgotten this newfound home they had in Christ. In Psalm 93, and if they had been thinking of this, perhaps they would have been better prepared. But in Psalm 93, verses 3 and 4, read, "The floods have lifted up, O Lord, the floods have lifted up their voice, and the floods lift up their roaring. Mightier than the thunders of many waters, mightier than the waves of the sea. The Lord is high," or "the Lord on high is mighty." And there are many verses that speak this way of God in control who overcomes. You know, when we're faced with a storm, we try to hide in something. We shelter ourselves because we can't control it. It's beyond our control. That is an impossibility. We can't control a tornado. We can't control a hurricane. And yet, God can overcome. And back to our question, why did Jesus have to walk on the water? Well, I think the answer starts to come if we go to Job 9. There's a few verses out of Job 9. And I think as we look at this, we'll find that it's a spiritual significance. It's not that he's trying to show off that he can walk on water. But in Job 9, verse 7, it's Job speaking, and he's speaking of God here. When he says, "He speaks to the sun, and it does not shine. He seals off the light of the stars, and he alone stretches out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea. He is the maker of the Bear and Orion, Pleiades and the constellations of the south. He performs wonders that cannot be fathomed, miracles that cannot be counted. When he passes me, I cannot see him. When he goes by, I cannot perceive him." What did Jesus do? There's this aspect in verse 10, there's this aspect of impossibility. Who does great things beyond searching out or beyond number? The comprehension that we just don't have. Yet Jesus walked on the water. He comprehended. He walked on the waves. He trampled the waves of the sea, just like we read in verse 8 of Job 9 here. And sure, we're talking about physical creation here, but Christ is the first fruits of the new creation. All things through him, and he can trample our waves. It's interesting how closely this verse 11 parallels the Gospels, because especially when we go to Mark 6, again, Job 9:11 says, "Behold, he passes me by and I see him not. He moves on, but I do not perceive him." And when we go to Mark 6, going in at verse 48, it says, "And he saw them toiling and rowing, for the wind was contrary to them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea and would have passed by them. But when they saw him walking on the sea, they supposed it had been a spirit and cried out, for they all saw him and were troubled. And immediately he talked with them and saith unto them, Be of good cheer, it is I, be not afraid. And he went up unto them into the ship, and the wind ceased, and they were sore amazed in themselves beyond measure, and wondered, for they considered not the miracle of the loaves, for their heart was hardened." Okay, a lot happened there. First of all, the parallel to Job there was this passing by. In verse 48 of Mark, he passed by the disciples. And they perceived him as a ghost. They didn't perceive Christ. They saw a ghost, verse 49, or a spirit. They could not understand. Their hearts were hardened, verse 51 and 52. We have this, the miracle of the loaves. It specifically mentions that they had not considered the miracle of the loaves. Their home, their understanding, wasn't with Christ, where it should have been. They hadn't crossed over, truly. They were still trying to go back. And so their hearts couldn't understand. They didn't see Christ for who he was. And I wonder if our own hearts don't see him for who he is. Do we maybe get a wake-up call once in a while and dismiss it as an apparition? I don't know if you can think of a time in your life when something, well, it's kind of speaking generally now, but something happens, but you look back and you think, you know, I should have taken the other path. I was being guided and directed, and I took my own way. And I think that's what's being highlighted here. He's passing them by because, and they don't see him for who he is. Also revealing, back in Job chapter 38, and I'm just going to pull a few verses out of this. Job 38. And this is God speaking this time. And he says, "Have you entered into the springs of the sea or walked into the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of deep darkness? Have you comprehended?" There's that understanding again. "Comprehended the expanse of the earth. Declare if you know all this. Where is the way to the dwelling of light?" And remember, we had Jesus going up, the disciples going down, and it was night, and Jesus was not with them. Where is the way to the dwelling of light? And where is the place of darkness, that you may take it to its territory, and you may discern the paths to its home? Which home do we have? This path to the light, or the path to the dark? Which gate do we open? Is it the gate of death? Or is it the gate that we open ourselves? Or is it the one that Christ opens for us? Verse 19, where is the way to the dwelling of light? Well, immediately you think of John 14:6, where Jesus says to them, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me." And again, in John 8, verse 12, "Then spake Jesus again to them, saying, I am the light of the world. He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life." Then the really stunning thing that ties it all together is verse 20 of Job 38 again. Verse 20 says, "That you may take it to its territory, you may discern the paths to its home." It has so much to do with what we're talking about tonight. Are we heading back? Back to our previous home? Or is Jesus helping us to discern the path of light through the darkness and through the storm and over the waves? Is he trampling those waves? Is he bringing us home? Or back home to him, as the case may be. So, why does Jesus walk on the water to his disciples? Well, whenever we consider why Jesus does something, there is always a spiritual lesson. And there's a spiritual lesson here for the disciples, and as we've seen, for us. And the other point is that not only is he the way, but he comes for us. The disciples were stuck in the middle of the lake. There was nothing they could do against the storm, and yet Christ walked out to them, and he met them. And when we fall, when we fail, when we in fact choose the wrong path and struggle, he can still come to lift us up and take us home again if we reach out to him. He will call us out. He will rather call out to us so that we really see him. And that's exactly what happened. The disciples saw what they thought was a ghost. And Jesus said, "Be not afraid, it is I." And then they recognized Jesus for who he was. He will call to us and then redirect us and take us home. This is again what happened with the disciples. He got into the boat and they were safe and the storm was calmed. The Gospels, in fact, John puts it very strongly and says that they immediately were on the shore on the other side. What does it say exactly? In verse 21 of John 6, "Then they were willing to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat reached the shore where they were heading." Okay, well, maybe that's another miracle, maybe it's not. The other two Gospels don't stress that point, but that's not really the main point. The main point is that they were safe. There was no more storm. There was no more worry on their part, because they were truly home again, because they were with Christ. He was their light. Now, let's move on to Peter. Peter also walked literally on the water. And we can learn so much from the details of what happens here. It serves almost as a double emphasis for the general incident of Jesus coming to them, because again we have kind of a more intimate situation here where Jesus is now coming to Peter. Peter is coming toward Jesus. And the emphasis here, I think, is on reaching. Well, one of the emphasis. We reach, or we must reach, towards Christ, but we can't always complete it. And so he completes it for us. He came out to the disciples, and he responded to their faltering. And he also reached out to Peter and responded to his faltering. And he will also reach out to us and respond to our faltering. So if he will reach out to us in this way, should we not also reach out to others? It's not just a safety net. Christ isn't there just to reach out to us, but it's an example. It's an example of the character of God, and that's what we're trying to live in our lives. Another thing, Peter seems initially focused. He's focused on the water and walking on the water. This is an incredible feat, but he believes, and through Christ he's able to accomplish it. So he's walking on the water, but then he loses his focus. So he's overcome one thing, but now he's got these other pressures around him. But it's interesting that he doesn't get blown over by the wind, but he starts to sink. His mind is occupied with all these things around him, but he isn't blown over by the wind. He isn't blown over by these things around him. He begins to sink. He loses his resolve on the first obstacle again. How frustrating that would have been. And I find myself identifying with it in that, how many times do we overcome something, or we think we overcome something, only to be faced with the same thing again, the same problem later. And yet, again, Jesus is there to lift us up. How many times do we forgive our brother? Now, Jesus physically lifted Peter up here, but he also... It's evident that he's spiritually lifted, and We'll come to this a bit later. But for now, I'd like to go to Mark chapter 9. In Mark 9, there's another example of walking on water, and this is no literal water here. This is a miracle, or a healing of the boy with the evil spirit. So we know how the story is that we have in Mark 9, beginning at verse 14, this epileptic and his father wants the disciples to heal, and the disciples couldn't. He brings them to Jesus. The disciples aren't our focus at this in this incident. But going in at verse 22, it describes what he's gone through. It says, "And it has often cast him into the fire, into water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." He's in a fix and he's crying out for help. Jesus said to him, "If you can, all things are possible for the one who believes." And immediately the father of the child cried out and said, "I believe, help my unbelief." Now, in verse 23, the version I was reading from actually puts it in such a way that you might think that he's saying, "Well, I'll show you that I can," but he's not trying to prove that. That's not the way at all that Christ is talking to him. He's speaking in an encouraging way. He's speaking, what he's saying is, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can move this mountain. Or as when he was calling out to the disciples, he's saying to the man, if you can, all things are possible. All things are possible for one who believes. What he's saying is, take heart. It is I. Be not afraid. And so in verse 24, at this point, like Peter did, the father reaches out. He's beginning to sink. And he says, "Help my unbelief." "Lord, save me," is what Peter said. And the father says, "Lord, save me." And so Jesus reached out and he healed his son and he lifted up the boy. He took the father home. He took him home to his faith, beyond his grief and his pain and the things of this life. Same ideas, they crop up all over. David, he's an obvious one. And we're going to go to 2 Samuel 22 for a moment. He was someone who was pursued. And whether we put ourselves in these situations ourselves or whether we're just suffering life because it's the way it is, David also was pursued. He felt the influence of the storm. He had enemies. In 2 Samuel 22, we have, and this is near the end of his life now, but we have David's song. And he describes his flight from Saul. And he also describes God's hand that's been near him throughout the whole thing. Throughout his life, God's hand was there. And going into verse 4, we're going to pick just a few verses out of chapter 22. "I call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised, and I am saved from my enemies. For the waves of death encompass me, and torrents of destruction assailed me." Verse 5. Verse 17, "He sent from on high, he took me, he drew me out of many waters." Verse 18, "He rescued me from my strong enemy, from those who hated me, for they were too mighty for me." Verse 29, "For you are my lamp, O Lord, and my God lightens my darkness." This just beautifully applies, I think, to Jesus. Verse 5, the storms of life, the predicaments that we sometimes put ourselves into. We're reminded of Peter and the waves and the wind around him. We're reminded of the disciples, and they're in the middle, in the thick of it. And do we listen? Are we listening for Jesus' voice? Are we listening? Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid. Then in verse 17, he drew me out of many waters, and Christ reached out and he lifted up. He lifted up Peter, and he lifts us up that we might not sink. David was lifted up. This is the kind of help that we have. And it's within reach. Not our reach, but it's within Jesus' reach. We have to make the effort. Many waters, verse 17, the other thing that comes out of that, he drew me out of many waters. It wasn't just he drew me out of waters, he drew me out of many waters. This happened again and again and again. I'm often in situations where I'm not equipped to deal with these things, but you are. The impossible is made possible. You can help me to walk on the water. There's multiple occasions. There's multiple problems. We're not just standing on the beach here, but we're stuck in the middle of the lake. Verse 18 again, 2 Samuel 22. They were too mighty for me. And the realization that we aren't equipped, and the realization that we have to reach and we have to come to God. And that these kinds of changes, the kinds of changes that we want to make in our lives to become more like him, we can't make on our own. And verse 29, that he guides us home because he is our lamp and he lights our way. And there's a calming because we're home and we've come home and we've come home to stay. And there's no more darkness. Psalm 118. Now this could apply to David. I'm not sure who wrote this psalm. Another example. Again, we're just going to take a few verses out of Psalm 118. They surrounded me, verse 11, surrounded me on every side. In the name of the Lord, I cut them off. I was pushed hard. In other words, we're pushed to impossible limits so that I was falling or so that we're sinking. But the Lord helped me. The Lord is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. Open to me the gates of righteousness, and that's the path home, that I may enter through them and give thanks to the Lord. We don't want to keep sinking back. We don't want to be caught crossing and going back to our old home. The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone, and now here we link directly to Jesus. Verse 27, the Lord is God, and he has made his light to shine upon us. His light is Christ, and that is the light of the world, the light of life. And he is our guide, and he is our shepherd. And so we have to remind ourselves that all things are possible with God. Jeremiah 32 says, Ah, Lord God, it is you who has made the heavens and the earth by your great power and outstretched arm. Nothing is too hard for you. Behold, I am the Lord, the God of all flesh. Is anything too hard for me? And I think we need to take time out just to sit back and remember how powerful God is. And that he's provided for us. And to be in awe. Now, back in John 6, we have what appears to be a very transitional period, because the disciples had taken things very literally. The disciples hadn't made Christ their home spiritually, but they still dwelt back in Galilee. And as we go on, we'll find that this changes. And we already alluded to this a couple of times, and alluded to the fact that Peter has learned this spiritual lesson, especially. And the spiritual lesson follows the natural feeding of the 5,000. And some leave to go home to what they know. Jesus here in the second half of John 6 is explaining how he is the bread of life. No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and then I will raise him up at the last day. He talks about how he is the bread that has come down from heaven. It goes on in verse 48, I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the desert and they died. But here is the bread that comes down from heaven, which a man may eat and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. And he goes on and on and talks about this, and he gets to the point where he's saying, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. And many of his disciples took this literally and thought, his teaching is too hard. It's impossible. We can't understand it. And so they leave. This is a hard teaching. Who can accept it? That's verse 60. And so verse 61, Jesus says, does this offend you? And he goes on to explain more. But they end up leaving. Many disciples end up leaving, and they go back to what they know, and they recross and go back to Galilee. Back to where they belong, or back to where they feel they belong, back to where they know how things are, back to where their hearts really are. But the 12 disciples, and Peter in particular, have grown. And here's the proof. They're no longer thinking in complete physical terms of belonging to their home in Galilee. But verse 66, from this time, many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. Jesus says to them, you do not want to leave too, do you? And this wasn't a hurt feelings question, but it was asking them if they were going to repeat their physical travel back to Galilee. Have you understood what I've been teaching you? I'm the bread of life. You have life through me. Your home is with me. And then Simon Peter encouragingly answers, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. In other words, I've made my home. My new home is here. It's with you. And he goes on, verse 69, and we have believed and come to know that you are the Holy One of God. And I got to wondering, well, have the disciples been thinking about these things? Have they been thinking after their experience with Christ and his walking on the water and this physical action, miracle, have they been thinking? Maybe of Psalm 107 where it says, then they cried to the Lord in their trouble and he delivered them from their distress. And he made the storm be still and the waves of the sea were hushed, and they were glad that the waters were quiet, and he brought them to their desired haven. That's what happened. And Psalm 107 lays it right there. Psalm 89, again, you rule the raging of the sea. When its waves rise, you still them. But the big point again here is that John 6 is transitioning. It's transitioning from the disciples thinking of Galilee as home to Peter saying, to whom shall we go? What an encouragement that would have been for Christ. What a help from having to send his disciples away because they couldn't understand that he wasn't to be made king, to this point where he says, to whom else shall we go? Well, they didn't get over that point of him being made king yet, but they've made their home. They've begun to make their home with Christ. And as should we, rather than going back alone to what we were before our baptisms. And so the impossible feat here wasn't the physical walking on the water. And now we can think of technologies and things that we can do to, in the physical world, achieve seemingly impossible goals. That wasn't the impossible feat, although it was a miracle. The impossible feat was the spiritual growth that they had experienced. To living with Christ rather than the comfort of their human homes or the ease that they had before their baptism. We have a conscience of Christ here to develop and nurture now. And so as we see Christ's example of reaching out, so must we. And how impossible, we might say. But here, there's still confidence that he will be near us. Let's just go to Deuteronomy 30, and I love this passage. Deuteronomy 30 and verse 10. This is confidence that he will be near us. Confidence that God, through Christ, will reach out. He's within reach. Verse 10, when you obey the voice of the Lord your God, to keep his commandments and the statutes that are written in this book of the law, when you turn to the Lord your God with all your heart, and where do we make our home? That's the emphasis there, and with all your soul. For this commandment that I command you today is not too hard, because all things are possible with God. It's not too hard for you, neither is it far off. It is not in heaven that you should say, who will ascend to heaven for us, to bring it to us that we may hear it and do it. Neither is it beyond the sea that you should say, who will go over the sea for us and to bring it to us that we may hear it and do it. Let's not put ourselves into the sea and into the storm, trying to strive for the impossible on our own. Making it very hard for ourselves to hear Christ's call. Hard for us to see him. Let's not make it hard for ourselves. But the word is very near you, verse 14. And Christ is very near us. It is in your mouth, it is in your heart, that you can do it. See, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil. So, the spiritual significance of the impossible, of walking on water, and not being affected by the storm, is that we have Jesus at our side. And it is by him that we are truly home. And the last two verses that I want to quote are Ephesians 4:14 and James 1:6. And they read, that we may no longer be children, tossed to and fro by the waves and carried about by every wind of doctrine, by human cunning and by craftiness and deceitful schemes. James 1:6, but let him ask in faith with no doubting, for the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. So let's remember, as we're sinking, not to reach for our inflatable shoes, because they won't help us and they'll have us upside down drowning in the water, but to reach out for the hand of Christ. who is our shepherd and our guiding light. And he will lift us up and he will take us home. Our home truly is where our heart is. So let's let it belong with him so that we also can reach out to each other and lift each other up and guide each other home.